Hello and welcome to another episode of Livewire's Rules of Investing. I'm your host and editor at Livewire, Patrick Polk. Today's guest is Michael Thorley, Vice Chairman of Capital Group International, the world's largest active fund manager. Before joining Capital Group, Michael was the Australian Ambassador to the United States and also held the post of Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, making him the head of the Australian Public Service. Today's episode will be focused on the political side of investing. So we'll discuss the US-China trade war, Australia's relationship with China, and we'll hear about the time he was personally invited to the White House by President George W. Bush. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at Livewire Markets, and visit our website, livewiremarkets.com. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the show, Michael. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much.
Well, look, let's start with a little bit of background. I mentioned in the introduction that you were the Australian ambassador to the USA for 5 years. I understand you had a fairly unique experience when you were leaving that office. Could you tell us about your final meeting with President George W. Bush when you were leaving your post as the ambassador?
Yes, happy to. It seems a long time ago now. But what happened was that he invited me and my wife, actually, to come to the Oval Office to say farewell. That's a pretty unusual thing to happen, actually, to ambassadors. And I don't think it was so much for me, although we had, both of us had got to know him and his wife and a lot of people in the White House quite well, but I think it was a sign of his great respect for our country and also his personal regard for John Howard. And I think he wanted to make a point that that Australia and the United States were very good friends and allies, and that that in the previous few years, while he'd been president, we had actually managed to achieve quite a lot between the two countries and the two governments. And it was actually an occasion which sort of reveals something about him that I don't think many people appreciate, those who haven't met him personally. That is that he's is a very, very friendly person with a great sense of humor and a very quick wit. And my wife and I went into the office, and there were three or four people there. My recollection is Steve Hadley, who was then the National Security Advisor, Andy Card, who was the Chief of Staff. I think Karl Rove was there, the political advisor, one or two other people. And we had a chat and a cup of tea, and then he sort of orchestrated this sort of arrangement. And then he said, well, we're not finished. He said, there's a whole lot of other people waiting outside the door here to come and say goodbye to you. And I think Cheney was there, Vice President Cheney as well. Anyway, he opened the door, and in came Don Rumsfeld, the Defense Secretary, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Mills, and Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense. So he sort of, you know, he just sort of orchestrated this nice little occasion, and it was very nice of him. He was a very charming person and a very nice man, and with a, I think, very strong sense of duty and sense of what it meant to be president of the leading power in the world.
Yeah, it definitely seems like, at least from my perspective, that Australia and the US had an incredibly strong relationship at that point in time. I'm not quite sure if it's as strong today as it was then, but I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that. But before we get into that kind of thing, I'd like to talk a little bit about history again. I understand that you've been involved with politics and foreign affairs since the 1970s. There's obviously quite a lot of political uncertainty around the world now, but certainly there has been in previous periods as well. How would you compare the current period of uncertainty with prior ones that we've seen, you know, throughout the 70s, 80s and 90s?
The world's always uncertain, so that's a given. But I think what I'd say about now is that I've never been more unsure about what the future holds than I am now. In the 70s and 80s, we had huge problems, and we were in the middle of the Cold War. The Soviet Union was a great power, and it was pressing its competition hard in various third world countries. And we were concerned about that in the 80s, in particular, about the pressure that the Soviet Union was putting on the European Union, and a sort of a game of nuclear blackmail. But there was a sort of framework within which these problems were worked out. The US alliances were very strong. We had ups and downs in the economy, but basically the economic structures were very strong. Progress was being made on international institutions like the WTO was being developed at the time. And so you sort of knew where the direction of events was. China was beginning to open up and reform. So you could sort of say that you could predict exactly what was going to happen, but you knew what the underlying structures were. I think the world we live in now is very different. The strategic balance of power in the world is shifting with the rise of China. So this is a very new factor, which and the outcome of which we can't be sure of. The politics in the Western world generally has become more fractious. Governments don't have strong majorities. We've had, in particular, I mean, this is a trend for some time, but the financial crisis in the late 2000s has encouraged sort of populist movements. So there's a sort of a sense of crisis of confidence in the democratic world. And the third thing is that in the economic scene, the sort of traditional patterns of growth are being disrupted. It's not just that the organizations like the WTO are under challenge on trade issues, but that the pattern of growth that we've been used to is shifting, and we're now in a world where there's extremely high levels of debt, but we've not really achieved the return to the economic growth that we were used to as a consequence of this, and everyone is concerned what this great load of debt might mean for the future of the economy. So they're huge changes, and the outcome is, I think, unpredictable. And the thing we have to keep in mind, that governments have to keep in mind, the outcome actually depends on what they do. You know, it's not just an automatic thing that these circumstances will turn out happily. I mean, fundamentally, I'm an optimist, but when you see governments really struggling to devise policies which will ensure a stable and peaceful future, you have to sort of worry more than we did, say 20, 30 years ago. Sorry, that's a long answer, but I'm not a pessimist, but I think we need to understand we can't afford to be complacent.
I think you need a little bit of optimism to be an equity investor, but complacency is definitely a dangerous thing. Let's skip forward to a little more recent issue. You mentioned about 18 months ago that you expected to see rising tensions between the US and China that could directly affect some companies, which I think it's safe to say that's exactly what's played out, probably a bit more severely than I think many would have predicted. So what's your view on the US-China relationship and where it goes over the next 12 months?
Well, I think this is we're in a period of strategic competition which will last for 10 or 20 years. And when you look at the economic relationship and the trading relationship between the US and China, one has to understand that underneath the choppy surface of trade disputes and so on, there's really a significant struggle for influence going on. And this has become really much more evident in the last year or two. I mean, it would have happened anyway, in my view, but since Xi Jinping became president, he has made it very clear that that China not only wishes to become the world's leading economic power and technological power, he also sees China as playing a very dominant role strategically in the world. So this is a really fundamental shift in the attitude of the Chinese leadership compared with starting with Mao Zedong, Deng Xiaoping, and Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao. This is a big shift. So I'm not expecting that this will lead to a military confrontation. So I'm not expecting the sort of most gloomy outcomes. But I think we need to understand that that trade disputes are likely to continue, and that any deals that might be arranged are likely to be temporary, and that they're going to be played out against this struggle for influence in the first place in the Asia Pacific, but also more broadly, globally, in Central Asia with the Belt and Road program that the Chinese have, and indeed in other countries as well, so that in other parts of the world. So I wouldn't want to be pessimistic, and I don't think that we're going to see an all-out trade war in which the world economy would be substantially damaged. But there are going to be sort of perpetual issues that are just going to keep on turning up, and solutions are going to be difficult, and they're probably not going to be sort of sustainable in the long term, unless there's a significant change in attitude on the part of the Chinese leadership.
Australia is obviously very dependent on both the US and China for trade in going and outgoing. I mean, as far as I'm aware, they're our two biggest trading partners. Is that right?
That's correct. China by a long way the largest, yeah.
So given that, obviously for Australia, it seems uniquely important, that relationship. What do you think could be some of the impacts that the trade war we're seeing currently, ignoring the possibility of further escalation, but, based on what we're seeing now, what would you see as being some of the potential impacts on the Australian economy?
Well, funnily enough, I think Australia probably once again is going to be the lucky country that if there are serious trade disruptions in the longer term, that means that economic growth is likely to be affected, but that's a sort of a longer term outcome. I think in the short term, the chances are that because of Australia's role as a supplier, the cheapest supplier and a reliable supplier of commodities, both mineral, energy, and agricultural, and because of the sorts of products that we offer in, say, the consumer area, highly reliable, clean, processed foods, because of the very good services sectors we have, especially education, that my guess is that we won't see a big effect on Australian trade with China. Now, the thing one would want to keep an eye out for is that the Chinese are very happy to use or very quick to use economic leverage when countries do things which displease them politically. So that's an issue, and that's why I think the Australian government sensibly calibrates how it talks about its strategic policies. There's no point in being needlessly offensive about China's ambitions. But But to my mind, Australia, compared with some other countries, is actually probably going to be less affected.
Well, that's certainly good to hear. Let's turn our attentions to the UK for a moment. Obviously, there's some pretty big problems going on there at the moment. There is a possibility of a leadership change. It looks quite likely that there may be a Brexit with no actual official deal. So should Australian investors be concerned by the Brexit negotiations, and why or why not?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think investors should be concerned. My own view on Brexit is that this was going to happen at some point anyway, that I think history and geography sort of always win out in the long run in the lives of countries. And if you think of how the this issue started, it was actually under Mr. Cameron at the time of the global financial crisis, and his concern that decisions were going to be taken increasingly in Europe, especially within the Eurozone and by those member countries, which would not take account of British economic interests. And so his whole effort to renegotiate elements of the UK's membership of the EU is driven by that. Now, that would have, I think, gone on producing difficulties for Britain, and so at some point this was inevitable. I think my own view is I think there will be a deal done. It'll be probably fudged in some respects, but that Britain will leave with some sort of understanding, a very broad understanding about the future in May 2019, and that then there'll be very hard negotiations, which will go on for a very long time, about the future relationship. But I think for Britain, I think the fears that the London as a financial centre will be finished or severely damaged, I think those are unfair. I don't think they take account of the whole network of capabilities you need to run a good financial centre. Not only the financial trading, legal frameworks. There's a whole network of capabilities that you need, and London has them in spades in a way that no one else apart from New York does. So I think that will survive. The key issue is how does the British government adjust the UK's economic policy to take advantage of the freedom that it will have. And I guess my disappointment would be in this that there's been too much talk about the ins and outs of the actual Brexit trade, the post-Brexit trade arrangement, as opposed to what Britain itself needs to do to improve its economic future and in particular its productivity.
Well, let's turn our attention back to Australia again. In recent times, it seems that the relationship between Australia and China has taken a little bit of a turn for the worse. Could you explain what's actually gone wrong with the relationship between these two countries, and what should Australian investors know about China that's being ignored at the moment?
Well, I think the relationship between Australia and China is actually not that bad. And I wouldn't myself worry too much about that. As I mentioned before, China has a history of using economic, commercial, and political pressure to get its way. And so sometimes there have been periods of no speaks because someone has said something that they find offensive and they want to make a point, sometimes it's worse. They harass some company's products because just to remind everyone that they're a big market and that China's a big market and that you can suffer if you don't treat it with respect. I think the key thing here is to know exactly what it is that you want to achieve with China. Be very clear about it and just stick with it, and not to there's no need to talk an awful lot. There's no need to react to every issue that turns up in a dramatic way. I mean, the media obviously makes that difficult, but I think that if you're a government, the best thing is to just stick with the course that you think is in Australia's national interest, explain it publicly and clearly so that both our own public and the Chinese understand what our position is, and just stick with it. And I think that history shows that the thing that China doesn't like is surprises, so it's best to be clear up front and just stick with it, stick with your position. For us, of course, China's a huge opportunity. I mean, it's still, even though it's not growing so fast, it's a huge economy. It's going to continue to change in ways which will benefit the sorts of things, benefit people who, the Australian producers of all sorts of products and services. So I think that there's scope for Australia to gain even more economically from the growth of China. But the problem we have is that that again, here's a policy issue for us, that Xi Jinping is in effect inviting countries to choose between their economic interests and their strategic interests, and we have to make sure that China understands that we're not going to abandon our strategic interests, that we can't be turned away from pursuing our strategic interests by economic leverage.
Okay, so my understanding is that the Chinese government was a little bit upset about the recent non-interference rules that have been discussed. Do you think just that the media is overplaying the significance of that a bit?
I think that's a very significant set of issues that the Australian government has been very right to have a clear position on. I think clarifying our rules about foreign engagement in our political system is very important, and every country, many countries have had much clearer rules on this than we have. For example, the US has long banned foreign donations to political parties. But this is a case where we need to be very clear why we're doing it and why it's important for the health of our democracy, and that we're not going to permit any criticism. Well, we will permit criticism, but we're going to defend the position we take. And of course, I think the thing here is, to reverse the situation. How would China feel were we to want to do some of these things in China? And of course, the focus is on China, but the rules are about foreign interference generally. I think that's an important point. This isn't all just China.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some domestic issues, getting away from the big geopolitical stuff. I know that you spent some time working for the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet as well, so hoping you're comfortable discussing some more local issues. I want to talk a little bit about franking credits. As I'm sure every Australian investor is now aware, Labor has promised to remove franking credit refunds if they win at the next election. Now, I don't want to get into the social aspects of whether or not the policy is fair. I think that's been discussed at length, and everybody's got their own view on that. But what I'm curious about is, do you actually think their policy is economically sound?
Well, first I should say that Capital Group as a entity doesn't have a position on a policy issue like this. So I'm very happy to talk about this, but it's sort of really their personal comments based on my experience in the government. On franking credits, I think that the reasons for introducing them, which were under the Hawke Keating government, I think were very good ones, and they still apply. Just to go back to that briefly, the interest was in encouraging companies to use equity capital as opposed to raising debt. It was to encourage ordinary Australians to invest in equities in order to give Australians a share in the increasing prosperity of Australia and the success of our companies. And the third thing was to avoid double taxation of dividends, because companies would have already paid tax, so why should the shareholder in the company have to pay tax a second time round on the same money? So I think those are all continuing very good reasons to have a franking credit system. Not many other countries do in the OECD, I think only three or four. And actually, just going back to George W. Bush, one of the reasons that his administration was very interested in the Australian policy of imputation, tax imputation, and we actually provided a lot of information in the period before the election, when they were to give the Republican Party some information about, you know, our own policy. It was one of the reasons we had a very sort of close set of connections with them when they came into office. And also the other point to mention, as a foreign investor, we don't benefit, capital groups, mutual funds don't benefit from franking credits. So I guess if we were to take a really sort of very selfish interest, we'd say actually it would be better for us if and our the shareholders, our mutual funds, if there wasn't such a system. But I think from an economic wide point of view, it's a very good thing. And as I understand it, the Labor Party isn't proposing that it would do away with the system. It's proposing only that where people don't have a tax liability, they won't get a cash repayment of the franking credit. So there the issue is the economic issue. You have to look at the whole balance of the taxation system. You know, you can't just look at this by itself. What is the overall impact on retiring people? What are the other sort of tax benefits and burdens that they face? How does it affect the investment pattern of companies and so on? So, I don't think you can sort of come to a view on this without looking at the whole sort of tax picture.
All right. Yeah, that's fair enough. And you are 100% right in what you're saying there. It is just the cash refunds that they're proposing to remove, not the system altogether. It's probably worth noting, though, I would say, that the cash refunds were only brought in after the system was introduced by the Howard government. When Hawke and Keating originally introduced the system, the cash refunds were not there.
Yes, that is right. And of course, one of the reasons it was introduced was that point was because the Howard government was running a very successful budget policy, and so had money to spend, and this was something which was very attractive to retirees, and that's still the case. You know, that changing this policy will affect retirees, and the question is, something which is a good thing or not? And you know, to answer that question, you need to look at the overall balance of taxation.
Yeah, taxation's is an awfully big kettle of fish, and unfortunately, not something that we have time to look at in completion at the moment. But I've got one more question before we move into the regular questions that I do as the final part of the interview. We've got, of course, an election coming up in Australia, possibly this year, but more likely next year. What do you think are the biggest policy issues for Australian investors coming into this election? And are there any particular sectors that you think are facing big political risks?
I don't think the sectors facing big political risks. I mean, I think that investors will look at Australia in a relative sense. And I mentioned before, Australia is a lucky country, so that's a significant benefit for us. The other thing is that we have run for all that we grumble about it, we've run a very successful economic policy. We have the budget deficit is shrinking fast because growth is good, as we've just seen from the most recent national accounts. We have a debt which is extreme, a national debt which is extremely low by global standards. So I think from the point of view of an overseas investor, Australia is looking good in sort of broad macroeconomic policy terms. I think investors, what's important for investors is predictability of policies. So we want to know that that the government's foreign investment policy is sensible and not going to be chopping and changing, that tax burden is managed in a way which doesn't reduce growth prospects. And as an investor, foreign investor, so to speak, but with a strong Australian background, I guess the thing I would say is that we, as Australians, we have to avoid complacency, that we may look back on this last period as one of missed opportunities, where we could have, we had the luxury of, because of relatively strong growth and strong national accounts, of making major policy changes which would set us up better for the future. And by that I think that, I mean, when I was back in PM&C, running PM&C a couple of years ago, I was disappointed that we couldn't do more in terms of tax reform. I was disappointed that that in areas like education policy and health policy, we weren't able to make bigger changes. I mean, it's a national scandal that we've managed in 10 years to about 2014, 2015 to spend 40% more on education, yet get results which are far worse. As I once said publicly, it's almost as if we set about trying to destroy the global competitiveness of our children, if you look at that situation from outside. So I think there are things that we could do to make ourselves more attractive and to set ourselves up better for the future. But relatively speaking, I think Australia is a very attractive destination for investors.
Well, I think that's a very important message for Australians to hear. Sometimes it can be, you get so caught up in what's happening at home, it's easy to lose perspective. So it's great to see a somewhat of an outside perspective on the issue. But look, let's move into our regular questions. I like to ask these same questions of all of my guests. However, I have tweaked the last one a little bit to be specific to you. I normally ask people about a stock idea, but I know that's not your speciality. So we'll change it up a little bit to suit your area of expertise. But first of all, before we get to that, could you share with us something that you've read recently, either a book or an article or some research that really blew you away?
blew me away. Well, I guess it's not my style to be blown away, but there are two things I would mention, which really, I just in the last 2 weeks I've come across, which really interested me. They both relate to the United States, and I'll mention them because I think they may be a bit of a surprise to some of your listeners. One is a book, and I can't even remember the title, but it's about Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and the Space Barons, I think it's called. I think the chap's name is Davenport, and it's not a beautifully written book by any means. What is very striking about it is how it's a reminder of the huge vitality of the US and its economy. And it made me think back to the days of the Carnegies and the Mellons, people who really built new industries, made vast amounts of money, and then devoted large parts of their fortune to things that were in the national interest and sort of great endeavors. And this is a conversation, this is a book about their space programs. Yes, it's called The Space Barons. and by Christian Davenport, and it's a very easy read, but it's fascinating because it just to me, you know, the idea that private individuals would actually take on what was regarded supremely as a government effort that is outer space is just extraordinary. And it made me think, you know, reading about the progress in the last decade or so of these rockets that they're developing, that I always used to think that use of outer space was sort of pie in the sky. But I think that if we look ahead, the next 10 to 15 years, judging by recent progress, we may end up with the most extraordinary things happening on the moon and on Mars, and that we should never underestimate it. The second thing that I read was a short piece by the son of one of my former colleagues at Capital Group who was studying at university, and he did a tour of the Midwest in small towns, medium-sized towns, and he came back and wrote a short report which he shared with us privately about the health of these cities and the extent to which, far from the decline that we tend to assume from the global financial crisis and decline of industries, the sort of revival and the sense of optimism and the ability of communities to pull together and change the future of their, you know, their local communities. And it was just, again, a very striking reminder of the vitality of US society. We tend to read all of the problem about all of the problems, and they're undoubted huge problems. But I think we shouldn't forget that there's this huge restructuring going on underneath all of this froth and bubble on in the social media and the front pages of the newspapers. Both economic restructuring with the introduction of new technologies, I mean, it's going to be very disruptive too. But it's also, you know, there's a new society being rebuilt here, and I think those two things just sort of made me think, you know, you'd be very foolish to underestimate, you know, the ability of the United States to reemerge as a leader. Obviously, can't ever be as relatively powerful as it was before, or economically dominant as before, but it's an extremely sort of vibrant and dynamic society.
We'll definitely get a link in the wire to this podcast to the Space Barons. It sounds as though we might not be able to get access to that report. Oh, but
no, just so, Pat, I should just mention, but then just the other day I saw, and I haven't read it yet, that James Fallows and his wife had done a trip through regional United States and have produced an article. And it sounds to me as if they're onto the same thing. And so that's in the Atlantic. And I haven't read it, but I noticed a sort of reference to it.
Excellent. Well, I'll see if we can track down that and share that in its place. Let's take a little bit of a trip back in time, so to speak. If you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give yourself just one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
Probably, I don't know that there was ever any hope that I would have done this, or that my own sons would do it either, for that matter. But I think, looking back on it, what I should have done was just save a little bit of money each month or whatever, and put it in a broadly based fund, or put it into the hands of a reliable, sensible financial advisor, and make sure that it was put in a broadly diversified sort of fund, or nothing fancy, and then forget about it for the next 30 or 40 years and do nothing except just steadily put the money in, and each week or fortnight or month, and just forget it. Because the more you shift your money around, the more exciting things you try to do with it, unless you want to spend your whole life on that, and some people do, you know, but for the ordinary person for whom money is a means to living a better life rather than an end in itself, the best thing is to find something which is a diversified financial product, get some decent financial advices to what what's available and what makes sense, and just forget you've got it until you really need it.
Well, thankfully, thanks to Paul Keating, actually, we have a system in Australia that allows young people to do exactly that, whether they like it or not. One final question, and before I ask it, I always like to say, this is supposed to be a little bit of fun and not taken too seriously. So normally I say don't try this at home because we're giving a stock idea here, but there's no stock idea. But regardless, it's an exercise in long-term thinking. So although the way things are going in Australia right now, it may not be all that long-term. So with that being said, the question is, who do you think is going to win the next Australian election? And do you think it'll be a minority or a majority government?
I'm the least qualified to make a guess here. I think that there'll be a majority government in the lower house, but the question will be in the Senate, where there's always a high likelihood of cross benches, and that always complicates the ability of a government to introduce its platform, follow through its platform with policies. I think the part of the issue now with all Western democracies is the political scene is so fractured with what I call postmodern interests. So that partly because Australia has been so fortunate economically, we have the luxury of worrying about a lot of social issues, which in themselves are important. But if you don't have a clear economic strategy, then of course you can't, and a successful one, then you can't afford anything. And so I think the risk is that elections focus too much on minority interests, identity politics, group issues, rather than the broader national interest. And to the extent that I think we focus on the broader national interest, the more likely it is that we will get a stable majority government, and that's I think something that we've seen in other countries, that's a blessing, because at least the government actually can carry out a platform, and then if we don't like it, we have the opportunity in Australia very fast, within 3 years, of throwing it out, and that would be a much better situation to be in. With a government with a clear majority and a clear platform, especially on the economic policy front.
Well, that's it for today. Michael, thanks for coming on the show and for sharing your insights about the political side of being an investor.
Thank you very much, Patrick. I've enjoyed speaking with you.
Well, that's it for another episode of The Rules of Investing. I hope you enjoyed the show. I've got a very exciting episode coming up for you next, where I'll be interviewing Ben McGarry from Totus Capital. Ben is one of Australia's best short sellers and the 2018 winner of the Best Market Neutral Manager at the Australian Alternative Investment Awards in Sydney. Before you switch to your next podcast, though, I want to hear from you. What or who are the questions or guests that you want to hear on the show? Email me at team@livewiremarkets.com and let me know, and I'll do my best to make it happen. In the meantime, please subscribe to us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at Livewire Markets, and visit our website, livewiremarkets.com. And as always, thanks for listening.